This is Wade Rasky. That means it's Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Time. We're broadcasting from KABF, 88.3 FM, 100,000 watts of people power in Little Rock, Arkansas. We're live streaming at www.kabf.org, and there'll be a podcast up by Monday. We're welcoming other stations who broadcast this show in Flagstaff, New Orleans, Dallas, Denver, we believe, and Seattle soon. And you know the story on Wade's World. Every week we talk to the most interesting people in the world. And this week we're talking to Tom France, an old friend and comrade, who is the regional western director for the National Wildlife Federation based in Missoula, Montana. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning, Wade. It's good to talk to you.
Absolutely. We try to get together every time I'm in Montana, but you're always traveling. You're always going one direction, and I'm doing nothing but going out and trying to catch a fish or two. But, hey, 30 years I saw on a website. Is this? Did you open this office 30 years ago? What in the world?
Yes, I did, Wade. I came out of law school at the University of Montana. The National Wildlife Federation offered me a job in Boulder, Colorado. I made a proposal to them to open an office in Missoula. They said, no, no, you're just a kid. Then some things happened, a couple of bumps for them. Some people left, and I got a call one morning saying, stay in Missoula. We think that's a heck of an idea. So that was what I wanted to do, and the Federation over 30 years has, we've had our ups and downs, as employers and employees will, but they've let me grow a lot and change the direction of the office as I've thought it needed to be changed. So it's been a good partnership these many years, and I've gotten to live in a place I like and do things I want to do.
Well, and a footnote to that is 30 years times you probably saved them just in rent, $10,000 a year. So next time you need help bargaining a wage increase, call me, because I can do 30 times 10 and tell them how much you saved them by insisting on Missoula. So
there,
look,
you go.
Tom,
thank you, Wade. I'll
yeah,
do that.
Anytime, you know. I have my union hat still. Tom, one of the last times I saw you was down at Centennial's, and you were on your way to a meeting in Yellowstone or somewhere and said something. You were going to do something protecting grizzly bears. Now, in Little Rock, they don't have too many grizzly bears left, but this is important. What happened to the whole grizzly bear wolf restoration program? Because I know you and NWF have been key in that.
Well, when I came to the West in the early 1970s, there were no wolves, and grizzly bears had been extirpated from most of the West, and both species were early on listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And so as I began my work with National Wildlife, we focused on both species. They're iconic. They inspire people in good and bad ways. From a conservation perspective, you can say with confidence that if a landscape can support grizzly bears and wolves, it can support almost every other species of wildlife that that landscape is capable of doing. So we began working with the Fish and Wildlife Service and many other partners on bringing back a population of bears in and around Yellowstone Park. It hit a low ebb in the early 1980s. There was real concern that the Yellowstone grizzly might go extinct. They had had high levels of mortality from bears moving outside the park. They changed some of their management programs, which had caused a lot of stress in the bear population. But through, again, the work of many, many different committed people and agencies, we really cut back on the number of bears that were being killed accidentally or through management actions. We removed a lot of the things around and in the park that caused bears to come into conflict with people. And grizzly bears are, you know, they're not that many of them. They're at the top of the food pyramid, so it takes a lot of land to support them, but they're also very adaptable, and the population there really responded well. And over my career, over our lives, I think Americans can take great pride in seeing this population that was maybe 200 in 1978 It's now 700 animals. The bears are in habitats and found in places they haven't been seen in 100 years. The population breakdown between females and males and cubs of the year is good, and the population continues to grow.
Now, that's 700 plus. That's in the whole, and what footprint is this?
That's the Greater Yellowstone, which is Yellowstone National Park in the northwest part of Wyoming, and millions of acres of surrounding public and private land, and give or take 10 to 15 million acres is where we find grizzlies. And the population continues to grow, as does one of the other important populations in Glacier Park. And I think in the next 10 to 15 years, we might be able to say that we have linked the populations, that is, grown from two smaller populations that, of course, are more susceptible to adverse impacts happening to them, to one big population, because bears will be found throughout western Montana, northwestern Wyoming, and northern and central Idaho. And that's one of our goals.
Well, that'd be fantastic. I mean, one of the great adventures of my family was camping in Glacier Park, and we took a little hike off the side of the road and almost walked into a couple of grizzlies down the ravine, having a little something there, a little berries or something. And, you're an old Minnesota guy. I'm an old guy from Wyoming originally, so I knew it was time to get the young'uns out of the way. So as we're coming down the trail, we start telling people, hey, there's a grizzly up, and almost, everybody would just, do a U and get around. Except we came to a group of about three or four Japanese tourists who were hiking there, and we said, there's a grizzly coming, and they ran forward.
Yep.
They wanted to see that guy. I thought, well, no, maybe I didn't do the right thing, but it'd be wonderful to have a big population. And wolves, they're making progress as well, because I know we start to hear more complaints from some ranchers. That must mean that population is coming back too.
Yeah, wolves are a little different story. Again, when I came to the West, there were no wolves here. There were wolves in Canada, and in the early 1980s, a couple of wolves, one pack, showed up in Glacier Park in northern Montana, and that was good, but the conservationists thought that wolves should be a species that was common throughout the Northern Rockies, and working through the Federal Endangered Species Act, we brought back a reintroduction program, and so wolves were reintroduced. We captured, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Canadian Wildlife Service captured wolves in Alberta, put them into dog crates and brought them south to Yellowstone Park and to central Idaho, where 50 wolves, give or take, were released in 1995, and another 15 in each area for a total of 60 were released. And the wolves really thrived in an environment that had lots of wild country and lots of wild game, and now there are 12 to 1,500 wolves in the three states of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. They're a more challenging species, really, to manage, because they will prey on cattle and sheep. That causes a lot of problems in some places at some times. They are very territorial, so if somebody's dog runs into a pack, the dog often ends up dead, and that, of course, is a sad situation. So with wolves, it's a lot about people management, trying to resolve conflicts, in some cases paying for dead livestock, trying to make those make the human heart, which is the most important wildlife habitat, a little softer when it comes to the conflicts that sometimes come with having wildlife literally in your backyard, which is what wolves and really grizzly bears in the Northern Rockies do. So we now have hunting seasons on wolves in Montana and Idaho. There are certainly people that don't believe we should hunt wolves at all, and I respect that viewpoint, but there are others and game managers that think we can hunt them without impacting populations. and that will help manage the conflicts. And that's the choice the states have made and one that we've supported. And even with that hunting, we continue to have very, very abundant wolf populations and are basically managing the top of the population, not the middle and the bottom. So it's, you know, again, when I came west, the howl of the wolf had not been heard in 70 years, and now you can go to a lot of mountaintops, and on the right night, you can hear wolves howling, and it really is a great wildlife restoration story that most Americans want to see happen in places where we can support wolves.
We're talking to Tom France, who's the Western Regional Director for the National Wildlife Federation based out of Missoula. So obviously you're talking, this I noticed as well, is something you spend a lot of time on, this sort of wildlife conflict resolution. So that's not just you acting as an arbitrator between a wolf and a person. That's part of your people management you're talking about, huh?
Yeah, no, it's with most wildlife, you know, they're give them a little habitat, a little a place to bear their young, a little cover, a little security, place to get out of the wind and the cold in the winter, and they're going to be okay. And the real challenge for America, for the world, is leaving enough places for wildlife to survive, and then making sure that human activities are not bumping up against and conflicts aren't causing those wildlife species to go extinct. And whether that's a duck in North Dakota that needs a wetland to nest and a farmer that has to say, well, I guess I won't drain that wetland, or a wolf pack in northern Idaho that might kill a cow or two, but we need to manage that conflict, pay the rancher, maybe kill the offending wolf but not the pack. And, you know, those are the kind of solutions that NWF has worked to make sure we have as part of our American conservation movement.
Well, now, I know and where you and I used to run into each other more recently, you know something about ducks here. I mean, they call you the duck captain down in and way before the duck show from Louisiana was so popular. You were the hunt captain down there in the Centennials at the famous Sleepy Time duck camp. And
yep.
What's the duck population look like now? Is it? I know I haven't been there for a couple of years. I guess since 2013 I passed through. Maybe it was even earlier. Maybe it was 2010. But has it come back down there? Or I know y'all used to count them pretty regularly.
Well, wait. I think one of the great conservation stories of the that's going on right now is with bird North American waterfowl and wetland dependent bird species. In 2014 and again in this summer, we are witnessing the largest breeding population of waterfowl that we have seen in North America since we started really seriously counting ducks and geese in the 1950s.
Wow, isn't that fantastic?
And you know, the weather and climate play a big part in that. We've had some wet years on the prairies where most of the best nesting habitat is, but you know, a whole host of organizations and agencies, some of, you know, the Arkansas Wildlife Federation and game and fish agencies in the south have sent money north to protect habitats and restore wetlands, and any number of local rod and gun clubs have done their projects. And so what's really happened in the last few years as we've had good nesting conditions, you know, this habitat that's been protected and habitat that's been restored has provided the base of nesting conditions that waterfowl need. And so the result is, even in a time when most of us think that that the issues facing the environment are tough, we've witnessed something that I really wouldn't have thought I would have seen. We really have had record numbers, and if you're a duck hunter in the hardwoods of Arkansas or a bird watcher on the Texas prairies, you've seen spectacles that are really a testament to how we can do good by wildlife if we're working together and pulling in the same direction.
Well, obviously, all around Stuttgart and whatever's left of the rice, I mean, the ducks just fly into there.
Yeah.
I mean, the flyway down to Louisiana has been, from what I read in the papers on the sports page, it's been pretty strong. Post Katrina.
And, I do want to say that the vigilance and ongoing work is really a part of it. We're right now in a struggle with primarily with agriculture and some of the other energy industry over new wetland regulations that the EPA has proposed that would help us protect those small wetlands that are at the heads of watersheds. We're in fighting for Farm Bill programs that pay farmers to do good by way of conservation, even while they're engaged in growing wheat and corn and soybeans. Sustaining those programs, sustaining the regulations is something that goes on every day. And really every American needs to recognize that they can play a part in making sure we have wildlife tomorrow and for our kids and their kids.
Well, there's no question about that. Now, Tom, even before you went to law school, and this is when you and I first met, you were an organizer with a group of farmers and ranchers in,
yep,
in Montana called the Northern Plains Resource Council, still active, I think 40 years
yep
plus at this point. I noticed you still got your hand in this mining fight with the National Wildlife Federation. Tell me about that.
Well, the National Wildlife Federation is organized around three principles. One is giving kids the opportunity to learn about and be in nature. Another is restoring and protecting wildlife and wildlife habitats. And the last one, the last major driver that we have is climate change and making sure that we have an environment that can sustain people and wildlife. So NWF and our sportsman supporters have been very involved in coal development issues in the Northern Plains and have worked closely with the Northern Plains Resource Council and other agricultural organizations on a couple of challenges. In particular, there's a proposed coal mine in southeast Montana at a little place called Otter Creek that would be the second largest strip mine in the world if it's permitted. There's a railroad that's needed to haul that coal to the West Coast, and there are coal ports needed on the coast to then ship that coal to Asia, which is where the coal market is now.
And that's a declining market, though. I mean, I went to a conference in New York back in it must have been the winter. And it said the China has made huge steps to cut down its coal use, and the water transportation of coal from Australia is way down, and they're not sure there's a market for these coal ports, harbors on the West Coast.
Well, you're
talking about a big strip mine in Montana. That sounds so 70s, doesn't it, Tom?
Well, there are markets, and there are markets, and there are speculators, and there are speculators.
Yeah,
and
I guess that's right.
Certainly a group of investors and a company, Arch Coal, that think that they can find contracts in Asia. And they have these very live permitting proposals with the federal agency that does railroads and the state agency that does strip mines and the port authorities in Washington that permit loading facilities. So, as you know from your organizing work, there are always a lot of things going on, some of which you control, some of which you don't. Maybe most of which you don't.
Yeah, I was about to add, maybe most of which we don't control, but we sure do throw everything we got at them, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. And in Montana and Washington and Idaho, there are a lot of people that are saying, why are we permitting these very destructive kinds of coal mines and coal ports in an environment where clearly the world is going to move away from coal? And these local impacts are real. They should be factored into our decision-making, and when you do that, we don't think these mines and railroads should be permitted even without the challenges of climate and carbon in the atmosphere.
And, I saw, are y'all in court on this, or how does the fight, I know you were connected, or you and National Wildlife Federation were involved in some litigation involving some clean air issues. Is that connected with these mines or something else?
Not yet. I mean, right now the coal mine is before the Montana Department of Environment and Environmental Quality, which will decide whether or not to issue a permit here in about a year and a half. The railroad permit is before the Surface Transportation Agency. And so we are, you know, at both a technical, legal level, making arguments to those agencies about how these facilities really don't comply with siting laws, why a railroad, a single-use railroad, shouldn't have the right of eminent domain over private landowners because there's such a limited public benefit. So those issues are at the administrative level. We're pretty committed to fighting it through, so I certainly think court could be an ultimate arbiter for these cases. But again, climate issues are increasingly about what the public thinks and how political leaders at the state level and at the federal level have reacted. In Montana, the governor here has come out in support of the Clean Power Plan rule that the Environmental Protection Agency is proposed. He's one of the few governors in the West that has been vocal in that support. He's saying we should be moving away from coal and that we can in Montana make sure that if we're burning coal, we're doing it in the right way. So that's really a reflection of his leadership, but also where people in Montana think we should be moving with these energy policies, which is away from dirty carbon-based fuels and towards more towards renewable energies and renewable and conservation futures that might allow us to cool down the planet a little bit.
And, of course, we have the Senate Majority Leader from the fine state of Kentucky who's so upset about these clean power things. He was actually taking the unusual step for a U.S. senator from the fine state of Kentucky to sort of reach out to see if he could, connect with any attorney generals and governors in a lot of those red meat states to see if they would join him in fighting these evil power regulations. So we're still living in a pretty polarized world out there. At least it's good to hear in Montana you have some help. And how about Idaho and Wyoming and some of the other places that you I noticed you were in North Dakota the other day when you and I were trying to connect. I mean, is that where are they coming down on something like the power plant rules?
Well, I'd say North Dakota is pretty hooked into the oil and gas pipeline, as it were. The Bakken development in western North Dakota is viewed. North Dakota was a one-note state with agriculture being the only thing going on, and the state has really embraced the oil and gas development that's come in over the last decade, and they have a small coal mining industry, so they have been pretty tough on any proposals to reduce dependence on fossil fuels. Idaho is not really in anybody. There are no resources there that are actively being mined. There's been quite a bit of wind development in the state, but it's also as conservative a state as you find in the West. So they've been pretty aligned with the Republican caucus in their reluctance to try and develop federal policy on climate and coal. Washington and Oregon has stepped up and said no to new coal port proposals because of their climate impacts as well as the impact on fisheries. Washington State is, we still have a permitting process going on there on coal ports, but Governor Inslee in Washington State has been one of the most outspoken governors in the country in saying we need to get a handle on climate and climate issues.
Now, when you get to that, Northwest Pacific biosphere, we got some friends. So, obviously, the Wildlife Federation involved in one fight after another as we're going through. How in the world do y'all get the support to engage as closely as is needed in all these fights, Tom?
Well, the National Wildlife Federation is in one of the larger conservation organizations in the country, and we have regional offices engage at a regional level in the conservation issues that we think are most important. But our support comes from a membership and supporter base of about 4 million people. The Federation was created in 1936 when Franklin Roosevelt convened a wildlife conference because of the crisis caused by the Dust Bowl. And people from around the country came and said, we need a national organization to deal with some of these issues at a federal level. But it really is a federation. We have, I think, 47 state affiliates, including the Arkansas Wildlife Federation and the Louisiana Wildlife Federation. And, you know, we come together. It's really a kind of, it's still a blue-collar organization, mostly hunters and anglers, but bird watchers and gardeners too. And so our support comes from a really committed base of people that recognize, you know, there are things we got to, that civilization and society and the economy are important, but that wildlife and clean water and clean air are as much a part of our future as good paying jobs, and that we can and should be working for both.
I got on the plane the other day with my son to fly from Missoula back south, and you know, there were four or five people that walked down the aisle with Razorback sweatshirts and T-shirts. And, you know, when I was at the counter, I heard them saying something about a guy heading for Thibodaux, Louisiana. So there's no question when it gets to be this certain season where it's steamy down south, a lot of us, you know, call it a gift if we get to places like Montana. But there must be a website or something where people could contact you and the Federation and see what they could do to lend a hand, who do care about what's happening in the West. How do they do that?
Absolutely. NWF.org will get them to our national website, and depending on what a person's interested in, they can click down through our regional offices and programs and our federal programs and click into our state affiliates if they want to get engaged with a local organization. And there's lots of good information that we provide. We've got a Northern Rockies Facebook page that people can find if they want to do that. And on that, we're providing regular updates on the issues we're most involved in right now, which I'd just throw in a pitch that our biggest wildlife program is we think we could restore thousands of bison to a place in central Montana.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, let's hear about the bison before we have to ring off.
Well, we and a couple other outfits have been trying to create a grassland reserve that would be a combination of federal lands dedicated to wildlife, but which we've not really maximized, and some private lands, and we could see our way to a couple million acres of grass in central Montana. And we are proposing to the state that we should build a wild herd out there of thousands of bison that would roam the prairies just as they did when Lewis and Clark literally pulled by this area as they came up the Missouri in 1805. So it's a lot of people kind of think, well, geez, bison, how can we have them in numbers? And again, you kind of start at the beginning, you find an area, you start chipping away at your habitat, and now we're at a place where we think the state should move forward and establish a wild herd, and that could be really a signal conservation achievement as we go into, you know, 2015 and the 20s, a lot of people can't imagine seeing 10,000 bison out on the prairie, but we can not only imagine it, we think we've got a plan to achieve it.
And what a great way for us to end this conversation with Tom France, Western Regional Director for the National Wildlife Federation, NWF.org, if you want to find out more about the work. And we're going to see if we can get some wild hoofs running in the Great West. We're going to repopulate them instead of depopulating the rest. This has been Wade Rathke with Wade's World, 88.3 KABF.org. The podcast will be up. It's 100,000 watts of people power. We'll be on again next Friday, 9 to 9:30 Central Time. Thank you, and goodbye. Bonjour.